Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This week, we hear about a documentary on the history of racial redlining in Lexington real estate, about the increasing intensity and frequency of weather events and wildfires, and how they're pushing insurance rates up, home values down. And we get a primer on weather radar from WLEX meteorologist Bill Meck. First, EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin wants to reverse his agency's own conclusion that greenhouse gases are a threat to public health and welfare. Zeldin's announcement came just after President Trump granted exemptions to the Clean Air Act for industries across the country. In addition, the EPA is terminating its Office of Research and Development. That's the arm of the agency that produces the independent, peer-reviewed scientific assessments that tell us what we need to know about the safety of the air that we breathe and the water we drink. Ashley Wilms is executive director of the Kentucky Resources Council. She's an environmental attorney, a former chair of the environmental law section of the Kentucky Bar Association, and Ashley currently serves as a member of the Kentucky Environmental Education Council. I've asked her to help us understand what these actions on the federal level mean to us here in Kentucky. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Ashley.
Thank you for having me.
And so first of all, what are your thoughts generally on all these actions taken in combination at the EPA?
Well, scaling back and even eliminating entire regulatory programs within the EPA, particularly those related to climate change and environmental justice, was a goal of Project 2025. So these actions aren't surprising, but they're 100% contrary to EPA's mission to protect human health and the environment. And this includes holding polluters accountable and reducing pollution so we can have cleaner waterways and breathe cleaner air. These actions are also consistent with an alarming pattern within the current EPA to not only chip away at existing regulations that, you know, in support of industry interests, but to actually stifle scientific findings to hide the impacts of pollution, particularly on fence line communities. And we've already seen the impacts play out here in Kentucky. In March, EPA canceled a grant to the Louisville Air Pollution Control District for an air toxics monitoring study in West Louisville. The study was part of a larger community effort with the Christina Lee Brown Environment Institute, West Jefferson Community Task Force, and Park Duval Community Health Centers to better understand and make public information about environmental impacts on health in West Louisville. This includes neighborhoods around like the Rubber Town Industrial Complex. The study was important because it was going to update an early 2000 study that found certain levels of pollutants in West Louisville that are cancer-causing were just too high. But the agency said the study was no longer consistent with EPA priorities. So this is just a local example of watching the EPA shift away from its mission to protect human health by keeping updated scientific findings out of the equation that could have helped clean up the air. You know, and with all these actions, EPA's credibility and objectivity is certainly at risk.
Well, there's something called the endangerment finding, and it determines the level of risk posed by a given emission, and that determination is the foundation of several Clean Air Act protections that limit climate pollution from such sources as power plants, cars, trucks, fossil fuel drilling operations, and the like. The EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin wants to repeal the endangerment finding. What would be the consequences to human health and the environment?
That 2009 endangerment finding determined that six greenhouse gases, including carbon dioxide and methane, are air pollutants that may endanger public health and welfare, and that emissions from motor vehicles and engines contribute to the elevated levels of these gases. And this finding was the basis for EPA regulating greenhouse gas emissions from new motor vehicles and engines. So if that endangerment finding is rescinded, then the corresponding regulations for the transportation sector, which is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States, would also be eliminated. Repeal of the endangerment finding may also undo current limits on the greenhouse gas emissions from certain factories and power plants, depending on the rationales that EPA uses to and includes in its final rule. But as you mentioned, this finding was built on decades of peer-reviewed climate science, and the support evidence is only growing stronger over time. So there will be an uphill battle for the administration to repeal it, and that decision will definitely be challenged in court. But if the Trump administration is successful, it's going to make it really hard for the U.S. government to limit greenhouse gas emissions. And we are the second biggest polluter in the world. So this is going to have a big impact on global efforts to tackle climate change as well. And sadly, we're just going to be kicking the can down the road. Somebody is going to have to address the impacts of these decisions. And they're deciding it's going to be our children and our children's children. The longer that greenhouse gas emissions rise, the harder and more expensive it's going to be to avert the worst consequences of climate change, including extreme heat, more powerful storms and deadly floods, crop failures, and food insecurity, all of which are going to have a devastating impact on human health and the environment.
Well, I got in touch with the EPA press office in Washington. I wanted to arrange for an interview with somebody to get the agency's perspective on all these changes, and they declined to make anybody available to talk with us, but they did agree to respond to written questions. So in an email, I asked about the rationale for repealing the endangerment finding and greenhouse gas regulations for cars and trucks. The response of the EPA press office was that Congress never explicitly gave EPA authority to impose greenhouse gas regulations for cars and trucks. Are they right about that?
Well, Congress didn't explicitly name greenhouse gases in the Clean Air Act when it was originally passed. But because flexibility is written into the Clean Air Act, the EPA is authorized to regulate these gases using its broader powers under the law. In 2007, in the landmark decision Massachusetts versus EPA, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that greenhouse gases are air pollutants under the Clean Air Act. The court found that Congress used broad, they called it sweeping language, to define the word air pollutant in the Clean Air Act. And this was to ensure that that definition would not become outdated as our scientific understanding of pollution evolved. So the court told EPA to determine whether greenhouse gases as air pollutants endanger public health or welfare. So at that point, EPA reviewed an overwhelming body of peer-reviewed scientific research and issued a formal finding that greenhouse gases for motor vehicles do endanger public health and welfare. And this became the legal basis for EPA's vehicle emission standards and also greenhouse gas emission limits for power plants and other stationary sources. So, I mean, really, this administration is trying to just deny settled climate science by frankly inventing legal distinctions that I don't think have any basis in existing law.
Well, this endangerment finding has been informed by the independent peer-reviewed scientific research carried out by the EPA's Office of Research and Development. And that office has been terminated by the administration. So I asked why, and the agency told me that this was done in order to, quote, improve the effectiveness and efficiency of EPA operations and align core statutory requirements with its organizational structure, that this research will now be absorbed by the agency's air, water, and chemical offices. Sounds efficient. Am I missing something here?
Well, unfortunately, I don't think this is about efficiency. I think it's about limiting scientific research and stifling the voices of independent scientists. That Office of Research and Development has always maintained an important distance between the research that it does and the political side of EPA's decision-making. And that's really been critical to the scientific value of its work. The Office of Research and Development was established in the 70s to serve as the agency's scientific foundation, centralizing the environmental research that the agency needed to implement federal laws like the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. And it currently houses the agency's Integrated Risk Information System, or IRIS, which is responsible for identifying and characterizing the health hazards of chemicals such as formaldehyde, arsenic, and ethylene oxide. This data is then used to develop regulations such as the Hazardous Organic National Emission Standards, but it's also been used to set risks and standards for, you know, more local things like Louisville's Strategic Toxic Air Reduction Program that we call the STAR program. By developing in-house data and risk assessments, the office can avoid relying on fragmented studies, but also studies that might be funded by industry. And courts that review EPA rules often look for whether the agency used something called the best available science standard, which is required by laws like the Clean Air Act. And having that independent research office has provided a real evidentiary backbone for things like when EPA updates emission standards. But of course, not everybody has been a fan. So the Chemical Council for years has been trying to shut down IRIS. Things kind of really ramped up when the risk values for chloroprene and then ethylene oxide were updated based on new science showing much greater cancer risks. But big industry polluters don't want stronger regulations, so they have been targeting the science regarding environmental pollution and toxicology. Unfortunately, without the Office of Research and Development and without IRIS, decisions about air pollutants, drinking water contaminants, and cancer-causing chemicals are likely to be made with less scientific integrity and more political and industry influence.
Well, now, parallel to what we're talking about, President Trump has granted exemptions to over 100 facilities. We're talking about chemical plants, coal-fired power plants, commercial sterilizers, taconite mills in at least 30 states and territories, Kentucky among them. And among these factories are industries that produce emissions of benzene, ethylene oxide, formaldehyde, chloroprene, the most carcinogenic chemicals known to man, and you've mentioned a couple of them. 4 coal-fired power plants in Kentucky have been exempted from mercury and arsenic pollution limits. So what can we expect to happen now that these chemicals will no longer be regulated?
Well, there are 2 significant parts to this. First, the president granted a 2-year exemption to an EPA rule that would have forced some of the nation's most polluting power plants to reduce emissions of mercury and air toxics. EPA said it's about ensuring affordable electricity, but many of these are aging and uneconomic coal plants, such as the TVA's Shawnee plant here in Kentucky, whose oldest generating unit began operating in the early 1950s. So it doesn't make much sense, given the availability of cleaner electricity sources and the high cost to public health from toxic metals such as mercury. Second, as you mentioned, the president recently exempted dozens of chemical plants from complying with the rule updating Hazardous Organic National Emission Standards for hazardous air pollutants. And so it's not that these chemicals won't be regulated, but they're not going to be, these plants aren't going to be subject to newer and more stringent rules. This exemption included Bakelite in West Louisville. The EPA promulgated this rule to improve air quality risk for high-risk communities by increasing monitoring and strengthening pollution controls. This is for some of the country's largest chemical plants. The rule was estimated to reduce elevated cancer risks from air toxic emissions from these plants for 1.2 million people. So in addition to protecting these industries at the expense of the health of our communities, the administration is just removing also another opportunity for fenceline communities to know more about what pollution is being emitted into their neighborhoods and thereby increasing their health risks.
An agency release that we have indicates that this termination of the Office of Research and Development is going to save money. It's going to save taxpayers roughly $750 million a year. How does that saving stack up against the cost to the public of the impacts of pollution on health and the environment?
Well, the health benefits of the rule updating Hazardous Organic National Emission Standards for hazardous air pollutants alone was estimated between $48 and $630 million per year. And that's a rule that would not have been possible without the independent research arm of the EPA. You know, manufacturing, energy production, industrial agriculture, these backbones of many economic sectors also produce air and water pollution, greenhouse gases, and toxic waste. And this pollution contributes to asthma, cancer, and premature death, especially in vulnerable and fence-line communities. So pollution regulations like those under the Clean Air Act save money and lives by reducing hospital costs, lost productivity, and even early deaths. So the return on investment for these kinds of regulations is massive when you think about it in terms of public health savings. When pollution is regulated, we know that Medicare and Medicaid and local health clinic, they have fewer costs because they see fewer emergency visits, they see fewer heart attacks and costly interventions, and all of this saves taxpayer money. So when EPA updated the carbon dioxide standards for power plants in 2024, it calculated that those standards would deliver, I think, around $390 billion in total climate and health benefits, which was like 20 times more than the cost of the industry. And of course, beyond economics, a healthy environment provides benefits that we can't quantify in dollars, you know, clean water, safe air, thriving ecosystems, and healthier kids and families.
Well, I have to tell you, I'm really struggling with something here. And that is to, now I get it that deregulation can translate to a healthier bottom line. But just simply as a practical matter, everyone, all of us, breathes this air, drinks this water. So isn't the repeal of these protections a danger to everybody, including the people doing the repealing?
Of course. Unfortunately, this EPA is ignoring the real impacts of its decision-making and saying corporate interests are more important than our health and then the environment. But making us sicker does not help the economy at large. You know, it helps short-term interests, and it helps the bottom line of certain industries that have this administration's ear.
Well, how is the Kentucky Resources Council responding to these changes?
Well, our mission is to protect Kentucky's environment and the health of our communities. So we're going to continue our work to hold polluters accountable and to ensure that people that are impacted by environmental decisions have a meaningful voice in the decision-making process. Given these changes at the EPA, for us, this really means more emphasis on encouraging and working with local communities and local governments to strengthen local environmental standards, and also to provide free legal and technical assistance that helps fill some of the gaps left by EPA in shutting down their environmental justice initiatives and their independent research arm. You know, as federal resources keep getting allocated away from oversight, you know, as EPA is cutting staff and trying to kind of dismantle everything, it's really important for us to participate in the decision-making at a more state and local level as well. At Kentucky Resources Council, we're also ramping up our education program, the Kentucky Environmental Leadership Institute. And we have a new website launching soon that I'm excited about that will have a lot of primers and resources for communities to help you better protect the places you live and love. So I hope your listeners will visit us at www.kyrc.org and also sign up for our newsletters so you can be in the know as we launch these new tools and host more workshops.
All right. That's Ashley Wilms, Executive Director of the Kentucky Resources Council. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We reached out to Congressman Andy Barr for comment on the same questions we posed to Ashley Wilms. We received the following response via email, and I'll quote it. Administrator Zeldin and President Trump are doing a great job rolling back disastrous Biden-era regulations and ending the war on coal that devastated Kentucky coal going all the way back to Obama. I'll continue to work with them to make America energy dominant again by leaning into energy-rich states like Kentucky, end quote, Congressman Andy Barr.
We know there's a drive to live at the heart of things. Gotta sink a pipe into that spring. To keep the world we know.
The National Weather Service has issued more flash flood warnings this year than in any year since record-keeping began in 1986. Incidents of unusually heavy rainfall have been increasing in frequency this summer, often with deadly consequences in the form of rapidly rising streams and rivers and the flash flooding that results. Are we prepared? What do we need to know to stay safe and to protect our property? We have these and other questions for Jeremy Porter, chief economist at First Street, an organization that draws on advanced climate science and engineering to quantify and communicate the risk for every property in the country. Thanks for joining us, Jeremy.
And thanks for having me on.
And I heard you on 1A recently talking about these concerns about the real practical consequences of climate change and wanted to see if we could distill some of that information down to our region here in central and eastern Kentucky. So first, a broad stroke. What can you tell us about our level of risks?
In those areas specifically, extreme rainfall is the way in which our changing environment and the climate shifts that we've seen over the last few decades are manifesting themselves. So we're seeing not necessarily more rainfall across the entire year, but we're seeing more rainfall in rainfall events. So we're seeing intense rainfall levels to the point that the Ohio Valley, you actually see the 1-in-100-year NOAA rainfall rate occur about once every 8 years now. So we're seeing these rapid intensifications of heavy precipitation events. And we saw floods on the Ohio River not that long ago, but the real ground zero target for the increasing rainfall is Appalachia. And in the areas where we're not mapping flooding very well, there's not major river channel flooding, there's not coastal storm surge flooding there. So FEMA really doesn't cover the heavy precipitation type of flooding. And what we're seeing in those places are more intense rainfalls and flooding in streams, creeks, smaller waterways that just aren't covered by FEMA zones.
This situation that you just alluded to, where the 100-year storm has now become like the 7- or 8-year storm, that must be messing with all kinds of things, including insurance, I would think.
Yeah. Insurance is based on historic observations of payouts. So when you're calibrating an insurance model, they're looking at what are we paying out in this area? What are the water levels historically in this area? But if that's a moving target, it's hard to plan for that. And it's hard to create an actuarial model where insurance can accurately reflect the risks that exist. So what we're seeing is insurance is responding to the payouts, to responding to the severity and the increased frequencies of these events. So we're seeing spikes in insurance. We're seeing it in the reinsurance market and in the primary insurance market. And really where we're seeing it the most is that it's hitting homeowners' pocketbooks as they're seeing spikes in their own insurance.
Well, the mountain topography of eastern Kentucky, the steep hollows, the many streams and rivers, makes the region highly susceptible to catastrophic flooding such as we've seen lately. And looking at it from a purely objective perspective, what can you tell eastern Kentuckians about the levels of risks that they're facing?
The levels are increasing without a doubt. And I think we are seeing more flash flood events, more extreme precipitation flooding events in the Appalachian regions than we've seen on record. I always tell people, you know, they're always surprised at the level of risk that exists in Appalachia. And I'll say, go Google flash flooding in eastern Kentucky. Go Google flash flooding in western North Carolina or West Virginia. And you're going to find that there are significant multiple events every year. And it's become the norm. I mean, people in eastern Kentucky don't have to think that far back to remember a time when there was a flash flood event that was nearby. And it really is driven by these increasing intensities in the rainfall events, the topography of the area, which feeds directly into those streams, those creeks, those smaller waterways, just haven't historically handled the amount of water that they're having to handle today from the historically intense rainfalls.
Is flood insurance available to everybody? And what about the rates? What's happening there?
It's technically available to everyone. If you want a flood insurance policy, the federal government runs the National Flood Insurance Program, or the NFIP. Anyone can get a flood insurance. You have to go through an insurance broker to get it priced. One of the really interesting things about that program, though, is that there are FEMA flood zones, which are designed to essentially delineate who needs flood insurance and who doesn't. But then what FEMA's done with the NFIP program is back in 2021, they actually changed the pricing algorithm so that now they're pricing insurance based on the actual risk in an area, but they're not including that risk in the development of the flood zone. So ultimately what that means is you have a lot of people that have unknown risk because they're not in a FEMA flood zone. But if they wanted to go get flood insurance, they could go get it, but their quote would be really high. And they would essentially have this mismatch between what FEMA is telling them their risk is and what the cost of their flood insurance is. And so while technically it's available to everyone, we saw huge spikes with the rollout of the what's called Risk Rating 2.0 pricing structure back in 2021, to the point that some communities in southern Louisiana, for instance, saw almost a 900% increase in their insurance rate as part of that change. Everywhere we're seeing, you know, 100, 200% increase. So you would expect that if you went to look for that rate in Kentucky, you would find a rate that's higher probably than you would expect for it to be.
When these insurance rates go up like that, what happens to property values?
We see a couple of things. We see, on the one hand, people just go without insurance. They're not protected from events. If an event does occur, they don't have the insurance to fall back on. So you'll see things like mortgage foreclosures, delinquencies, defaults, things of that nature. But you also see in the market itself, people negotiating for the increased cost of insurance. So if somebody buys a new home nowadays with the increase in flooding, they're also quoting flood insurance, and they're trying to understand what the risk looks like and what insurance costs will be. And as they go to the closing table on new home purchases, essentially they're negotiating down the price to account for that additional cost of homeownership. And what that does is in the transaction records, it actually looks like property value loss. We're seeing people buy homes for less because they cost more to maintain and to manage.
Well, your data is out there. It's available as a tool on real estate sites like Zillow, for example. What can we find by checking out that information?
You may remember when we first launched, our mission was to quantify and communicate climate risk. And one of the ways that we did that was by integrating our data on Realtor.com and then on Redfin and then on Zillow.com, and now also exists on Homes.com. But the idea was that, you know, we wanted to make sure everybody understood climate risk when they made the most important purchase of their life, which is generally your home. And now you can go on to those sites when you're in the home buying process. You can see that data next to the school score, next to the walkability score, next to other characteristics about the property. And people are making climate-informed decisions with that information. But they're also linking back to our own site at firststreet.org, where we have information on damages that you could incur from the flood risk or wildfire risk or wind risk that you have. But also, what are some solutions? What can people implement in their own properties and in their own communities to help protect those properties?
Well, Jeremy, I think we all want to keep a positive outlook. It's become a bit of a challenge these days. But I have to ask, and it's a dire question, but have we reached a point of no return? Can anything be done now to slow or stop or even, this is optimistic, reverse the effects of climate change?
It's a question that, you know, I'm more of a, you know, an economist, and I work on the implications of climate science exposure. But our climate scientists here at First Street essentially tell us that we're pretty much baked in to the next 30 years. Whatever we do today is something that will impact us, you know, 40 or 50 years down the line, where we could see some leveling off. We could see some reversals of some of what we're seeing today. But we're pretty baked in right now. We are going to see more intense, more severe, more frequent climate disasters for the next few decades, just based on where we are today. And what we're seeing is that people are taking this information and they're trying to adapt. They're trying to be more prepared. They're trying to understand, you know, what our near-term future is going to look like and how we protect ourselves from it. But in the near term, we are going to continue to see increases in climate disasters.
All right. That's Jeremy Porter, Chief Economist at First Street. Thank you so much, Jeremy.
Thanks so much for having me on.
With these storms becoming more frequent and intense, it's good to know a thing or two about weather forecasting. And that's why John Bobel, who's joining us as a contributor on emergency response, has invited as his first guest WLEX meteorologist Bill Meck. Bill, welcome to Eastern Standard.
All righty. Thanks, John.
As the science of weather and certainly the science of television weather forecasting has evolved, radar has become a much more important part
of the forecasting capabilities. Why is radar so important to what you do?
Radar is a key in nowcasting, in alerting us and through us to the public where dangerous weather is. You can look at all the models you want, and all a model is still just a depiction of what it thinks is going to happen. But a radar tells you what is happening now. It tells you storm structure. It gives you a good idea as to what is happening at the ground. And if it's a significant enough situation where we need to alert the folks, then that's the tool that we use. A live radar is obviously better than a not live radar. And truth be told, the National Weather Service radars, as good as they are, and they are valuable and they are necessary, but they are not live. Even at optimal conditions, it's going to be a couple minutes old at least by the time you get it. And if you're looking at it on an app, it's going to be a lot more than that.
Now, the radar here that is installed at WLEX, that's not something you went to Sears and bought. That's a very expensive, highly tuned piece of technology.
It is. And it's now, believe it or not, it's 20 years old. I mean, that's the amazing thing. We did do a replacement on it a few years back. Or we replaced some of the guts and updated it finally. But that radar has been with us since 2003. For Lexington listeners, we had it the fall before the Masterson Station tornado. And it was the only radar that saw that tornado. Part of that is because of its location being here in Lexington, makes it the most accurate radar that there is for this part of Kentucky. What happens with a radar beam is that it increases in altitude the further it gets away from the site. That's just physics of it, because the Earth is curving away from it and because the radar itself is set at about a half degree tilt up at its lowest level. And so it's already beginning to rise as it leaves the radar. So by the time it's sitting over Lexington, or the beams are over Lexington, they're a good 5,000 to 6,000 feet up. That means you're missing whatever's going on in the very lowest levels. You just aren't seeing it. It just, you know, you're seeing what's up in the cloud, but you're not seeing what's going on below. And so our radar, the MaxTrack, which is a C-band radar, 250,000 watt, a professional full power C-band radar, it's able to see the things that the NEXRADs can't, just because of location.
The whole issue of radar, it's interpreting what is seen, what the radar is able to pick up. It's much more than just watching nothing turn green, yellow, orange, red, and then there's the dreaded purple.
Purple. And we actually have a color palette that goes to black. So when it goes to black, that means you've got big hail. That's that symbol.
So what else, other than colors, does a radar like this tell you and the rest of the meteorology team?
Well, it's telling us a story. The average person can look at the radar, and everybody's got a radar on their phone now, but you're looking at pretty colors. You know, obviously, as you head toward the yellows, the oranges, and the reds, and the purple, that's when things are getting heavier. Well, that usually just means heavy rain. It can mean hail, but it doesn't tell you, say, if the storm is tornadic. If the storm is producing a tornado, it's not going to be at that worst part of the storm more often than not. It's going to be displaced usually to the south and west of that. And so that's what we're looking for when we're looking for a storm that has rotation to it. So a lot of times when you're seeing on a radar display, and if you've got an app that's highlighting, you know, this is where the storm is and where it's going, it's off the centroid of the worst part of that storm. Again, that's not where, if it's tornadic, where it's going to be. It's where the hail is, where the heavy rain is, but not necessarily where the tornado is going to be, which is why you need a meteorologist looking at this. Okay, here's the data, here's what we're seeing, and here's the folks who need to be really worried about this.
What is Doppler radar and why is it important?
Okay, the easiest way to explain what that is, if you're standing by a highway or standing by the train tracks, as a train or a truck or something's approaching you, the sound that it makes will get higher in pitch because the sound waves are being compressed. As it's going past you, the sound gets lower in pitch because the sound waves are being stretched out. Same thing works with the Doppler radar. All a Doppler radar is seeing is an object that it's looking at moving toward the radar or away from the radar. And at what speed is it doing it? So the radar sends out a signal, at a certain frequency, hits the raindrop. If the raindrop is coming toward the radar, the reflection that comes back, which is all the radar is seeing, is that reflection, comes back at a slightly higher frequency. If it's going away, it comes back at a slightly lower frequency. That's how we're able to tell if there's stuff coincidentally moving toward or away from the radar, which is the indirect way to say that there's rotation going on in that storm.
How do we get more accurate forecasts?
So right now, I do 8 days. I hold myself accountable for five, truthfully. There are forecast models that go out 15 days. We delightfully call that model fantasy land. So I'm not sure if we ever get to that point. When I started in the mid-80s, you know, we did today, tonight, and tomorrow. That was it. So I think a week is a pretty good place where we're going to be. If you see somebody doing a two-week forecast, just kind of smile and nod. So in terms of forecasting, we're really good with the short-term stuff. I think we do really well, obviously, with severe weather. Not perfect. You know, the Pulaski County, London tornado from back in May, that was a well-forecasted storm. It was. Before the day started, we didn't know exactly where it was going to be a bad day. But as the storm unfolded, the folks in the path had 15, 20 minutes warning. But some you just didn't get the warning to them. And that's the part where we've got to try and get better. How do we get the information to them?
And how do we get people to listen?
Yeah, because there's also the cry wolf scenario where Doppler radar sees a lot of things. And it, again, is an invaluable tool. But it also creates a lot of false alarms. The error rate on a tornado warning is about 70%. 7 out of 10 have nothing that goes on. So that can lead to the cry wolf scenario. But the theory is it's better to overwarn than underwarn. You don't get in trouble if you overwarn and nothing happens, but you do get in trouble as an agency if you have a tornado and there was no warning.
Now, we've seen that recently, not necessarily with tornadoes, but other weather systems and weather events where the warnings have been either late or non-existent, and there's been loss of life.
Yeah.
Certainly, we want people to pay attention and have at least 2 or 3 or 4 reliable, credible sources of information.
Have something that can wake you up.
Have something, you know, a NOAA weather radio.
Yeah.
And then pay attention and don't wait. Take heed of what you're being told. If you have to leave, leave. Don't wait for something to happen and say, gee, if I had only.
Yeah.
Bill Meck is the chief meteorologist for WLEX-TV. Thank you for being here today on Eastern Standard.
Absolutely, John. Thank you for having me.
For Eastern Standard, I'm John Bobel.
Coming up after the break, you'll hear about a documentary coming to the screens of the Lyric and Kentucky Theaters on the history of and present-day racial segregation in Lexington real estate and a vision for the city's future.
I hope that this results in the willingness of citizens in Lexington to be willing to stay open and curious about your neighbor, be willing to take in a perspective and a lived experience that's different than your own, and value that. Don't write it off and start to realize that while your neighbor may live different, may look different, may believe different than you, that they are human and they deserve to be valued and uplifted as well.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at weku.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top 5 stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. The film Lexington, Resilience in the Red Line, is about past and present residential segregation in Lexington, how it impacts black land and wealth, and potential ways to level the playing field. You're going to hear more about that in just a few minutes. Kristen LaRue and Regina Lewis are here to tell us about this film and what it documents about life in Lexington from the perspective of a black resident of the city. It's produced by Black Yarn, an organization they co-founded along with Rona Roberts and Barbara Sutherland. They're getting ready to screen the film later this month at the Lyric Theater. We'll have a little bit more on that in a moment, but first let me tell you a little bit about Kristen and Regina. Kristen represents something very important to the strength of a community: business professionals who have a sense of civic duty and are willing to share their knowledge and experience in their chosen field, for Kristen that's real estate, because they see things that need attention. Kristen grew up in Lexington, went to high school at Dunbar, where she was in the Leaders in the Making program and on the Herald Leader Teen Board. She went on to graduate from Fisk, Belmont, and UK. Last year, she was identified by the Herald Leader as one of the 24 people in Lexington to keep an eye on. And the reason for that is what brings her to us along with Regina Lewis, a doctoral candidate at the University of Kentucky Martin School of Public Policy and Administration. Regina does data. She focuses on the connection between public policy and imbalances among racial groups, and how these disparities lead to adverse outcomes and limited economic mobility, especially in areas like entrepreneurship, education, and home ownership. Regina and Kristen are here in the studio. Kristen, you've made a direct link between your personal experience as an African-American growing up and living in Lexington with your professional life as a realtor here in the market. So tell us about that connection.
I started in real estate in 2018 with me and my husband. Both of us are lifelong Lexingtonians. We were born and raised here, and we have multiple generations that have lived in Lexington. And so to be able to sell property in this community has been very, very impactful. A lot of people that we sell to, especially first-time home buyers, sometimes don't even realize that they're able to buy a home. They just generationally hadn't thought that it was possible, whether that be due to their family history and redlining or just being locked out of the home buying process in general, or whether they just had never seen it done in their family before. And so it's been very eye-opening and meaningful to be able to sell homes and to be a black realtor here in Lexington. There are more than you would think here, but we are definitely not the majority of agents. And so being able to be out in the community and work with people and help them to feel comfortable in the home buying process is really important.
And you mentioned redlining, and that's what this documentary is mostly about. Mm-hmm. I wonder if people really realize that that still goes on.
So redlining itself doesn't go on the way we typically think, but what does happen is the effects of it still live on. And so some of those same areas that you see on the older redlining maps, they are still being impacted by the policies that have happened previously. You'll see differences in their health disparities. You'll see differences in their life longevity, their income, their home values are drastically different. So when you look at the map, redlining itself isn't still happening, not in the same way that it had happened back in the 50s and 60s or so, but the impact of those policies, the impact of that practice is still prevalent within our community, yes.
Regina, as I said, you do data.
I do. I love data. I love the numbers.
What do the numbers tell us about this?
Yeah, so I'll give you an example. So as Kristen said, redlining, it's a past policy and decision that still has very present implications on resident experiences today. We go around and do presentations about the research and things that we found. And one of the things that we do is look at two communities in Lexington. So one is the Georgetown Street community that was redlined formerly, comparing that to the Ashland Park community that was greenline, right? So greenline means you get the resources, you're worthy of investment. These areas are less than 5 miles apart, right? They're about 3 miles border to border. But in one community, the average life expectancy is 16 years longer than that of another community. And as you can probably guess, it's the Green Line community that has a longer life expectancy. We also see differences in poverty rate, the racial makeup of the community, as well as the value of your home. So this Georgetown Street community and this Ashton Park community, they've been residential areas for a really long time. But the average home value in the Ashton Park community is just over $500,000, whereas the average home value in this Georgetown Street community is actually under $100,000. So you see a big economic disparity even in home values, with over $430,000 difference between these two areas that are less than 5 miles apart. And so I think that's the impact that we see today of these decisions that were made in the past.
So what we're talking about here are legacies of a past that remain, that linger, and in a very meaningful way. And probably to many people who are listening to us, kind of under the surface and not all that well realized. So that's what you're trying to bring out with this documentary, correct?
This is Kristen. Yes, that's correct. We want to make it to where people, when they look at the city, they have a better understanding of why it's made the way it is, why the layout is the way it is. So when you look at the north side of town, why do I see a lot of minorities or Hispanics or brown people on the north side of town? Why do I see, you know, Southland Drive look the way it does? What was here before? Give people a better understanding of the city that they live in and how policies have impacted our community from the past to the present.
I want to get back to you on what was here before, because that's an interesting aspect of all this. But first, I want to be sure that we recognize the partnership with Rona Roberts and Barbara Sutherland. How did that happen? How did they join this effort?
It started with them. So they didn't join. We joined them. They had been doing research since 2020. 2020 was a big kind of racial reckoning year for a lot of people. And that was a big year for them. And they decided to start doing research. They started their website, Segregated Lexington, and they formed a whole presentation and they took that around town. I linked up with them when they were scheduled to present that presentation to Bluegrass Realtors. So at the time, I was full-time in real estate and leadership with Bluegrass Realtors. And they came in and did their presentation for us and several other leaders. And it just really impacted me. As they presented their data, it resonated with me that this is the story of my family. This is the story of how the Black middle class was built in Lexington. And it's a story that, while the numbers are meaningful, so are the stories. And so I wanted to kind of bring to light that they should connect the numbers with the stories. And so I offered to help them connect with some of the people in the community, some of my grandparents' friends and whatnot, to see if we could capture those stories so that they could illuminate the numbers just a little bit better.
And you mentioned that there was a presentation to realtors here in Lexington. How was that received?
It was well received. What was obvious to me was enlightening to the rest of the room, which was really interesting. It really, in that moment, helped to realize that we have very different lived experiences within the same city. So as they were talking, like I said, for me, it was like, oh, this is the story of my family. It's obvious to me. But for them, they were like, wow, this is interesting. I didn't know this. And so just the difference between the two also solidified the fact that we really need to talk about this a little bit more and share it more. So that, you know, the lived experiences of others isn't so underground that it has a opportunity to have some light shine on it.
Out of this came the organization Black Yarn.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about its mission, either of you who wants to talk about that.
Go ahead, Regina.
Okay. Black Yarn is a nonprofit with the goal to shine a light on systemic harms. And we do that through research, storytelling, and collaboration. And our goal is really to connect the Black experience with that of all Americans. A part of that storytelling is documentary form. So that is what is coming out this August, but also a couple different other ways that we try to do storytelling, research, and collaboration.
What sorts of initiatives does Black Yarn have in the works right now?
So besides the documentary, we have a project going on down at the county clerk's office. This is under the supervision of Barbara Sutherland. She's leading the deed research project where they're going through and manually pulling deeds and looking back at the records to see where these racially restrictive covenants were, which houses they were assigned to, which neighborhoods they were assigned to, with the goal of mapping them. And so we're trying to get all these records identified so that we can, like I said, put them on a map so that when it comes to applying for grants or making policy decisions, we can more easily identify which areas were impacted and then which areas might need some additional supports. In addition to that, we have a running volunteer list. And so Regina and several other of our team members have been out graciously doing house parties for the past 6 months. And so people of the community have hosted us in their homes, and Regina and others have come in to present. And through that, we've met tons of people. And they've all asked, well, how can I get involved? Volunteering is definitely one of those ways you can get involved. The running list is so that we can be the hands and feet for other organizations. So we're not going to be continuously putting on events and programming necessarily. We might have some, but we really want to show support for organizations that are already doing the work and connect people that may not otherwise have a connection to these organizations so that they can become more aware of what's happening within their community and get involved.
In the introduction, I mentioned that you're getting ready to host on August 23rd at the Lyric Theater a debut screening of Black Yarn's first documentary, Lexington Resilience in the Red Line. What are we going to learn from that film?
You're going to learn the history of how Black residents have been in the Fayette County area for many generations and where they stayed. And you'll learn a lot about hamlets, Black enclaves, historically Black neighborhoods, and how they developed. You'll also learn some of the impacts of entrepreneurship within the Black community and how that's really grounded the Lexington community, but it's been really kind of unspoken about. You'll also see the diversity within our community and how it supports itself. We have over 30 different residents who've signed up to be a part of this film, and they range from the young to the old, from white to Black, and they are all speaking with one voice and advocating not only for visibility and homeownership and understanding our past, but they are advocating for diverse stories to be able to be carried on into the future and to be honored throughout the future.
And you're making this an event at the Lyric. Tell us a little bit about that.
So that day you'll be able to come. There will be a research reception. So Regina's research will be on display that people can interact with. We will have an interactive art display as well. It'll be yarn focused for Black Yarn. And we will also have food and drinks that are included into your ticket. So when you come, you'll have food and beverage. Afterwards, we will transition into the theater for a panel discussion, followed by the screening of the documentary.
And where can people go online to buy tickets and find out more?
Yeah, they can go to blackyarn.com to buy tickets. Just click the buy ticket link up on the website. And if you want to learn more on our documentary page on the website as well.
All right, that's Regina Lewis, Kristen LaRue from Black Yarn. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
The Lyric Theater screening is a fundraiser with an admission. There will be a second admission-free screening of Red Line, sponsored by the Bluegrass Community Foundation. That's happening at 7 p.m. on Tuesday, August 26th at the Kentucky Theater. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while you're there, you can check out our archive, our contributors and their interviews, and you can sign up for our newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. And would you like to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.